So the topic for tonight's talk is how conduct bears fruit. And I really want to talk about training in the first precept, training in not killing. In the Middle Link Discourses, the greater discourse on the ways of undertaking things, the Buddha speaks to his assembly and he says, "For the most part, beings have this wish, desire, and longing. If only unwished for, undesired, disagreeable things would diminish, and wished for, desired, agreeable things would increase. Yet although beings have this wish, desire, and longing, unwished for, undesired, disagreeable things increase for them, and wished for, desired, agreeable things diminish." Now, what do you think is the reason for that? And so the discourse goes on to answer, and basically he points out that people who are not skilled in the Dhamma and do not know what should be cultivated and what should not be cultivated go about life doing the very things that bring them suffering instead of the things that bring them happiness. Basically, people keep blowing it because they don't see the way that their action, the way that karma bears fruit. So I want to focus tonight on this first precept, the training to refrain from killing. And I'm going to be using this precept as a way of exploring some of the basics of karma, how our actions bear fruit. Now, Buddhism gives a very detailed analysis of mental states and uses a detailed analysis to explain why some actions lead to pain and other actions lead to happiness, why some states are considered wholesome and others are unwholesome. And so I've drawn a lot on the Abhidhamma analysis of states that defines the ethical components of our experiences and our choices. For some of you, the Abhidhamma system might be new. Don't get too stressed out over the details or the system of categorization. Just rest back, relax a little bit, listen somewhat gently and openly. And perhaps something, though probably not everything, will be meaningful to you. Abhidhamma is such a mainstay in Theravada Buddhist countries like Myanmar that even school children are familiar with it. But most of us don't know much about Abhidhamma because we teach it a lot less in Western and American Vipassana groups. But even if the details are somewhat unfamiliar, I hope that you'll just bear with me and listen in a relaxed way. According to the Abhidhamma structure, all unwholesome states include four universal unwholesome factors. And those four factors are delusion, the shamelessness of wrongdoing, fearlessness of wrongdoing, and restlessness. And we basically need these four factors to all be present in order to break the precepts, in order to do something harmful and unwholesome. Each unwholesome state, in addition, is characterized by a cluster of other factors that produce the particular flavor of that state. So we might have a state that certainly includes the four universal unwholesome factors: delusion, shamelessness of wrongdoing, fearlessness of wrongdoing, and restlessness. But greedy states will perhaps have greed and wrong view, or conceit and wrong view, whereas other states might have hatred but not greed, or envy and hatred, or kind of stinginess or possessiveness and hatred, or worry, sloth and torpor, or doubt. Whether the unwholesome state is just a mild craving for a second brownie, or an extreme state of genocidal hatred, or kind of that chronic, trivial, restless distraction that we sometimes entertain. All four universal unwholesome factors will be operating along with some selection of occasional factors to characterize that state. Now, in addition to the basic cluster of the mental factors that are present in each state, the Abhidhamma also distinguishes certain unwholesome states as being prompted or unprompted. Prompted states might literally be urged on by others. You know, somebody says, do this bad thing, or you're swept up in the actions and the influence of other people. Whereas unprompted states are those unwholesome reactions that arise very easily and very frequently without much in the way of external prompts, because there's such a strong inner movement toward that unwholesome action. Now, prompted and unprompted doesn't only apply to unwholesome states. Wholesome states can also be prompted or unprompted, but because I want to focus on this first precept, I'm kind of focusing a little bit more on the unwholesome states, that movement that would actually cause us to break the precept. But there's another distinction in Abhidhamma, that Abhidhamma categorization, which I think is interesting. And it distinguishes some actions as being associated with knowledge or disassociated with knowledge. And this is an interesting difference in terms of the precepts. For example, this is the difference between hurting someone with the full awareness that you're doing something harmful. That's associated with knowledge. The knowledge that it's wrong, the knowledge that you're doing a harmful act and that there will be consequences for it. This is contrasted with doing a harmful act and denying that there's anything wrong with it, justifying it, supporting it with delusion. The idea here is that there isn't one moment. It isn't just like one thing is an unwholesome act. There might be one critical moment in which there's the intention that brings out the action, but that event is surrounded by many other moments. There's many cognitive events, many mind moments, many cognitive processes that are involved in doing an unwholesome action, you know, from thinking about it, considering it, choosing to do it, planning to do it, engaging in the doing it, and the reflecting on doing it after. And although there might be one sort of really particularly powerful cause, kind of primary cause of the karma that ripens in that experience, that one karmically potent moment is supported and affected by many other moments of thought, of action, and of inclination. So there could be a dominant force that determines the course of your action, but all the conditions that surround an action will influence the intensity of the patterns that condition your actions, that will affect which actions form our habits, and how they affect the way that we experience that state. So in this sense, understanding this, we can understand that there's actually a lot of power in the reflection that we did during the meditation earlier, where we reflected upon our own virtues. Because if we learned to reflect upon our actions and we reflect upon our virtues, the reflection on the virtue strengthens the wholesome container for virtues, thereby reinforcing the tendency toward virtue. If we learned to experience joy and self-respect that comes through good conduct, we are reinforcing that those virtues and that's good conduct. So it's worth considering, do you frequently delight in wholesome states? Do you let yourself just be glad and happy that you made a good decision? This recollection of virtue is a practice of literally remembering, recalling, bringing to mind times when you actually had an opportunity to do something harmful, like break a precept, but you actively refrained. And so we notice the experience then of joy and self-respect that comes with refraining, with this moment of restraint. We learn to associate that renunciation of the impulse, the restraint component, we associate it with joy and self-respect. And these can become very powerful supports for our own practice. And we don't have to be saintly to do this practice. We can choose very ordinary actions. Some action that we did that was good and that we were happy to do it. They can be very simple, very quiet, very ordinary experiences. But we notice that the mind in that moment was free from agitation and free from distress, free from that dis-ease that is caused by doing unwholesome things, unskillful things. An example of this might be a time I can recall when I was walking down a country road and there was a snake curled up in the middle of the road, sunning itself in the afternoon sun. And as I was walking along, instead of just passing it by, I mean, would be very easy to pass it by. I was aware that there was a car coming quite a bit in the distance, but nevertheless, a car coming along this same road. And I was concerned that it would kill the snake. And so I stood in front of the snake and the car could see me easily. And I could wave it past. I mean, I wasn't standing on a freeway where cars were going super fast. I didn't feel in danger to stand in the middle of this road because they could see me very easily. And they just went around the snake. So it was a very simple action to do, but I had to pause to do it. I could have easily just kept walking past it and, you know, c'est la vie, you know, however it works out for the snake, that's not my business. But instead, I decided to take a very simple act that kept a being from being killed. And it brought me great joy just to realize that I could pause for that moment and in that simple way, protect a little life. There may be many times when you've had opportunities that feel more significant than this to refrain from killing or to protect a life. I have a friend whose husband is a veterinarian. And whenever I would see her, she was always surrounded by a pack of dogs, never less than six, often 10 or 12 dogs, because people would bring their dogs to the vet to be put down. And sometimes it was a rather curable condition, but the owners didn't want to deal with it. You know, they didn't want to take the time to administer the medication or to do what was needed to help the dog to heal. And so the vet would ask to take care of the dog rather than put it down and basically take the dog home. So they had this pack of dogs. Fortunately, they had a very big kind of like outdoor kind of area on their property that the dogs could play on, because you couldn't really do that in an apartment. They were out in the country. So that was pretty nice. But I think it was again another opportunity that they had. It wasn't the easiest choice to make. Those dogs kept them busy, but they made the choice to do that. Many people have served in various occupations where you might have had to, you know, in the military or in police or in different situations in life where you might have had to take violent actions as part of your job. It's quite possible. Or had to make a decision to kill or not kill even another human being. And it's important to reflect upon that decision, that choice, and why you made it and what was going on in your mind when you made it. There are times when we make a choice to kill even when we know that it's wrong. And there are also times when we make a choice to not kill, where we found an alternative, or we have embraced quite fully the commitment and the power to refrain from killing. To whatever extent we can be in touch with our capacity to refrain from causing harm can bring us tremendous joy and self-respect. It can be a great support for our concentration practice. Some people think, oh, well, that's so Pollyannish in a way to talk about precepts, and it's out of touch with the reality, or we're not really in touch with the reality of many people who live perhaps on the street, or perhaps in gangs, or in other situations that are not as, you know, that where these choices are quite difficult. But I think also the situations that we face in many ways are complex. And even this first precept to refrain from killing can be a very difficult one for anyone in any situation in life or in society to keep strictly. For example, any property owner will at some time or other face some kind of pest infestation. Whether it's the rats that get in the basement or the attic, or whether it's the wasps that build their nest in your mailbox, or whether it's the bees that find a hole right by your doorbell, or whatever it might be, there's almost inevitable sometime when you have to decide to kill or to not kill. I think Buddhists are kind of have a reputation for liking to use the examples of the ants, because those ant invasions seem to come like clockwork with the weather in different places. And so we consider these, you know, whether it's a roach infection infestation or ants invading the kitchen. One thing we often do is, instead of taking a kind of a real purist stance, we investigate. We investigate our minds to see what is going on there. And we investigate our options to see what options we have. Are there options that involve no killing? Can we take those options? Are there options that involve less killing? What is happening in the mind? Are we willing to really recognize the hatred that is in the mind when there is the wish to kill? Can we at least include that so that there's no justification and delusion involved in those actions? I can vividly recall a time not so long ago when there was this rat infestation, and I was crawling underneath the sub-level of the house, and I definitely experienced aversion. I mean, you know, when I saw the nests cluster of the rat nests clustered by the heater under the house, and the mounds of snail shells that they'd left after their meals, and the kind of greasy smeared marks of their bodies along the walls and their tracks, and the various maze of holes and passageways that they had dug in the walls, and all the kind of, like, it really felt as though my home had been violated. And the stink, oh, the stink, because one had died in the walls. So the whole house just stunk like this dead carcass. There was no question that I wanted them gone. There was no doubt that there was an aversive state in the mind. And I could, of course, justify it, health concerns, you have to get rid of them. But nevertheless, instead of just justifying it, we could look at that unwholesome state and learn a little bit more about our minds. And know that that motivation was rooted in aversion, in anger, in hate. But along with it, I felt a lot of reluctance to kill. Even if I wasn't going to do the killing, I felt a lot of reluctance to plan and hire the killing. And a lot of dread with the thought of killing. And a strong, strong wish to try to avoid the killing. And so I spent a lot of time researching various pest control options and trying to figure out what would be effective and what would be legal and what would be healthy and, you know, what were the options? And that's because of the reluctance that surrounded the hate-rooted thought to eradicate them from my house. So I mention this because I think it's an example where we can see that there are often conflicting mind states, conflicting motivations in the decisions that we make. And even if you decide to kill, we don't do it gleefully or easily. As much as possible, we enhance and strengthen the competing wholesome forces. We strengthen them. And I think that's important to do, even if in the end you reluctantly put out a trap or put out bait or do whatever it is you feel you ended up having to do or you ended up choosing as the option. At least you searched for alternative and at least you took that hurtful action only reluctantly. There certainly are times when people kill. We see that all the time. People kill to defend their home, their territory, their countries, their families. But imagine how much less killing there would be if we didn't kill in order to protect our personal pride or our ideological philosophies or views or our self-image. Some people kill for remarkably trivial reasons. Maybe, and when we kill for trivial reasons, then we're really not respecting or reinforcing any respect for life. There's no capacity for restraint. We read about incidents like this all the time in the news, and of course there's lots of TV programs, plays, theater, movies, etc., that are in crime dramas, that there'd be millions of examples of this, where there might be a shooting spree because somebody felt disrespected or they got passed up for a promotion at work and can't bear that disrespect, and so they lash out. Or people killing out of jealousy or out of a bruised ego or as a kind of ritual, an initiation perhaps into a gang or as a way of proving themselves or their self-worth or their personal power or killing for financial reward. I saw a magazine article a while ago about a really rather horrible ritual, or we could call it a rite of passage or a rite of manhood that's still practiced in some of the Northern European countries. And this article showed beaches just filled with rows of dead dolphins and crowds of young men in wetsuits kind of boasting their kills. And they would go into the water at a certain age, it was like a ritual, a rite of passage, to prove their manhood by slaughtering dolphins. And somehow that was cheered on in the society, which to my mind is just absolutely horrific. And from the Buddhist perspective, to cheer on killing, to praise it, to encourage it, just is putting the unwholesome on top of the unwholesome on top of the unwholesome. It's just like making a real heap of unwholesome states. What a contrast it would be if the culture asked young men to have the courage to refrain from killing. What a very different world we would live in. I wouldn't want to imply that killing is something that only evil people do. And that because we meditate, that we're somehow more spiritual than that and we're beyond that. We must observe the mind and examine the roots of our thoughts, the roots of our reactions, and consider what the roots are from which our decisions and actions spring. When are we speaking out of hatred? And when are we speaking out of love? When are we acting out of hatred, and when are we acting out of love? The thoughts that we have affect our words, and our words affect our actions. So we can notice when aversion or carelessness or a disregard for life kind of gets the better of our intentions and overshadows our good intentions. We can examine the causes for any time that we break our sila, break our virtue, break our precepts. Why did we give in to, why did we consent to speaking or acting in any way that was motivated by greed or hate? If you do, when you do, assuming you're not already at the third stage of enlightenment, there will be times when you do, pause, reflect on that. Don't just justify it in a way that condones those unwholesome actions. At least know that it's wrong. At least see and investigate the motivation that allowed you to speak in a way that was hurtful and harmful, and or act in a way that was so. I think it's very important too, not only that we reflect on these kinds of actions that we might have taken that were rooted in greed or hate, but I think it's important that we also make an explicit commitment to not kill. I don't think it's sufficient that we happen not to kill our neighbors or our family members or our friends just because the occasion didn't come up. I think there's power in taking the vow to not kill. And that's supported by our mindfulness, and it strengthens our capacity for restraint. When we make an explicit commitment to not kill, we're far more likely to question any impulse towards aversion or anger. We are more likely to refuse to kill when other people expect us to kill. People often wonder what the Buddhist stance is on issues like mercy killing or abortion or assisted suicide. And people have lots of opinions about different things about like this. People have opinions about whether it's right or wrong for assisted suicide of patients who have, for example, a terminal illness. Is this kind of murderous killing, or is this a compassionate action? Similarly with questions of abortion of a severely disabled fetus, or perhaps of an unwanted fetus, or the putting down of animals who are in pain, or the killing of animals for the benefit of science or medical research, or the hunting for food, or raising animals for meat, or killing pests even to protect your vegetable garden, whether you kill them organically or you kill them with pesticides. From the perspective of the precepts, it's still killing. In Buddhism, a person is not considered evil because they've killed. Every single act of intentional killing, though, is considered inevitably unwholesome. Actions of killing will always have an unwholesome karmic potential, because killing is always rooted in greed. Intentional killing is always not an accident. That's a different story. Intentional killing is always rooted in greed or in hate. In this sense, it's understood that killing is never associated with wisdom, with panya. But it can be associated with what's sometimes called non-delusion. It can be associated with or without the knowledge that the killing will bring an unwholesome karmic result. The belief that killing will have no karmic result indicates a strong delusion that's reinforcing the unwholesome actions. So that's killing with full delusion. It's also possible to kill with the knowledge that this is wrong and that this will cause consequences, that will cause painful consequences. The Buddha specifically emphasized this kind of karmic understanding in relationship to breaches of these precepts. It was a direct counterpoint to a philosophy that was taught by some rival ascetics in ancient India, who taught that since everything's empty, there's no karma, there's no fruit of action. And some of these other philosophies that were debated at his time really opposed the idea of merit and demerit. And we might be more familiar, perhaps not so much with these philosophies, but maybe with some echoes of it in some of the stories, like the Hindu story of the Mahabharata. And you might remember that there's a rather famous scene where I think it was Krishna who was counseling Arjuna on the eve of a battle that he must kill, and he can kill without remorse, without worry, because spiritual liberation in that philosophy comes through sort of a surrender to one's duty, one's social, one's duty in life. The duty of a soldier, the duty of a warrior, the duty of a fighter is to kill. But the Buddha was disagreeing with this kind of thinking. He emphasized that action always has a karmic potential, and that the conditions that contribute to the karma are complex, and the results of that karma can be mitigated by a variety of factors. For example, I've been emphasizing, if the choice to kill is made reluctantly and with the knowledge that there is a karmic price to pay, fully knowing that actions have results and that this is a harmful action, aware that there are painful consequences that are coming from that action, and knowing that we have to bear those consequences, there's a lot less delusion that's reinforcing the action than if we were to be justifying the act of killing. There are lots of complex situations in which good people kill. Someone might be overwhelmed by physical pain and choose to commit suicide. But what is, you might wonder, well, what is the, how is that rooted in anger? Isn't that of self-love or of compassion? But actually, they might be hating the pain or hating the thought of becoming a burden for their family. It's that thought, it's that hate that is the unwholesome root. Someone might assist another person's suicide also because they hate seeing the person in pain. Someone might kill a beloved pet because they just can't bear to see them suffer slowly. They hate that feeling. A scientist, so those are kind of examples of hate-rooted actions. A scientist who's greedy for fame might perform very cruel experiments. But the root of that, even if the medical, or even if the result is something that helps life, helps people, helps something, they discover something, the greed for the fame and the conceit in that process is also an unwholesome. Butchers do not hate cows, and hunters do not hate elk, yet their actions are still rooted in the unwholesome defilement of having greed for the meat, even if it's not hate for the animal. A soldier could kill out of hate towards the enemy or out of greed for their role or for their job. A terrorist might strap a bomb to their body out of hatred, or perhaps out of a greedy desire for a promised reward, heavenly reward. When people kill, they may or may not hate the particular people that they are killing. They may or may not be wanting any particular benefit. But the intentional act of killing, according to Abhidhamma thought, will always be influenced either by greed or by hate. and therefore it will always be associated with an unwholesome tendency. In classical terminology, unwholesome acts of killing are classified as double-rooted consciousnesses. They have either greed or hatred as one of the roots that they come out of, but never both, because according to Abhidhamma, greed and hate can never arise together. They can arise in close proximity to each other, but they can never arise simultaneously. But there is always the universal factor of delusion. Though delusion can vary in intensities, as I've said, sometimes there can be the delusion there that causes the unwholesome action, but it's mitigated by the knowledge that that is a harmful action. So, but in addition, this wisdom or knowledge is an occasional factor that may or may not on the other side of things, I just spoke about the unwholesome. On the other side of things, there is also the wholesome. And so we might say that the commitment to not kill, the taking of the precept, that is a very wholesome act. And wholesome actions are always rooted in both non-greed and non-hatred. So those two factors arise together in all unwholesome and all wholesome, positive, beneficial states. But this knowledge factor, this wisdom factor, is occasional, and it may or may not accompany the wholesome state. So the absence of knowledge, though, the absence of understanding of kama and knowledge doesn't necessarily imply the delusion that we would put as the unwholesome, the unwholesome root, because delusion isn't present in wholesome states. So for this reason, the wholesome states are classified as either double-rooted or triple-rooted. Double-rooted, which just have non-greed and non-hatred. Triple-rooted would have non-greed, non-hatred, and wisdom. So that was a lot of roots and a lot of doubles and triples, but hopefully you got the gist of it. Basically, one can, these different forces and factors are involved in the decisions that we make. And as practitioners, we can look to see what is actually conditioning this thought, this mood, this intention, this action. We can do good actions for many different reasons, and many mental processes circle around the performance of a single action. For example, when we sit in meditation with the commitment to develop mindfulness and the purity of a concentrated mind, we are engaged in a very positive and wholesome process. The action is most powerful then when it is done with the knowledge that, for example, the concentrated mind is a cause for liberating insight. But it can also be done for what we might say was wrong reasons. We could still sit and concentrate the mind, develop mindfulness and concentration, but we might have surrounding that action a lot of pride and conceit in succeeding as a meditator, or a craving for the pleasures of the concentrated states, or a desire, an unwholesome desire to prove our meant to increase and prove our kind of mental prowess. There could be a greed for kind of worldly productivity, you know, because meditating can actually improve our performance, for example. So we look and see not only what we are doing, but what kinds of forces around it are affecting the primary action that we're doing. We might protect life. For example, sometimes I'm sitting in front of a room meditating in a retreat, and there are mosquitoes, especially if the doors and windows are open. So there's mosquitoes buzzing around the meditation hall, and I will refrain from not killing. But every once in a while, there might be these mixed motives. Okay, it's quite possible to refrain from killing, partly out of a desire to protect the life of the mosquito and that full loving respect of life to maintain the precepts. But there can also be a kind of a greedy desire to maintain the stillness and quiet of the meditation hall, or a kind of prideful thing is to just not be seen killing, because you certainly wouldn't have a lot of respect for me if I was sitting there trying to give a Dharma talk and swatting away at all the mosquitoes that were flying around. So this act of restraint, it's still an act of restraint. It's still rooted in this non-greed and non-hate. It's still very much a wholesome action, but there can be countless moments, conscious moments, and other forces that circle around it, affecting the degree of purity of not killing or the degree of harm involved in killing. So in this sense, karma is really not clear cut. It's never simple. Sometimes people keep the precepts also, you know, just like that for the wrong reasons. Maybe because they want karmic rewards. But this, the meaning of understanding karma and the precepts is quite deep. By understanding the workings of karma in action, we can intentionally increase the benefits of any wholesome act. We can make a wholesome action more potent by associating it with wisdom, a wisdom that understands causes and effects, that understands what leads to the suffering and the end of suffering by associating it with bright view. Reflection can reinforce the power of our wholesome deeds because we can recognize the wisdom of those deeds. Hence, we reflect upon our virtues as part of our meditative reflections, our recollection of virtue. We could also consciously link our virtuous deeds with an aspiration for peace, for enlightenment, or some altruistic motivation. We might think, may this virtuous action be for the benefit of all beings. May this generous action or this gift or this good deed be a contributing cause for inner peace and for peace in the world. Or may this development of concentration be a contributing cause for the realization of Nibbana. So we sort of fortify a good action that we're taking. We surround it intentionally and consciously with other wholesome motivations, other thoughts that kind of reinforce the goodness of it, and with the right view and the wholesome states that can support that that good karma. So I'm very happy that you've stuck with me on this topic and have been willing to listen to a teaching on, in a way, the most basic of the precepts, the precept to not kill. This maintaining this one simple precept and investigating the mind in relationship to it can bring tremendous joy and strength, a kind of inner strength, a kind of self-respect that comes with the power of restraint, and a wisdom that comes through examining our actions and understanding how they bear fruit. The wholesome karma forces that develop through our precept practice can serve as a profound resource for happiness throughout our lives. And perhaps, according to the Buddhist tradition, it may be true that they might be a resource, our wholesome deeds might also be a resource for many future lives as well. So those are my reflections on how karma bears fruit and how our action bears fruit, and focus on the precept of not killing. We're getting close to our closing time, but I do feel like I should give you at least 5 minutes to ask any questions, and then we'll close with a brief metta. Does anybody have any questions? I may have confused you a wee bit with a lot of those terms or categorizations. Just unmute yourself and ask. Or if you prefer to jot something in the chat box, we can.
I have a question. I thought it was interesting that you said that greed and hatred do not arise simultaneously, cannot arise together.
Yeah.
And I had never contemplated that, and I'm going to have to think about it. But I could see, because for me, it's almost like I could see how greed could lead to hatred.
Greed can lead to hatred, and hatred can lead to greed, yes.
But
they are not, they're incompatible in the exact same mind moment. Yeah, and you'll notice that, and you'll be able to also, when you look closely, now that you're interested in it, look, you might notice, and this happens a lot, like we get angry, and mm-hmm. then there's a boosting of conceit. Conceit is a greed-based state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the I want,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the anger, and then there's the I want and the anger. So they can arise in sequence, but they're different. And when you look closely at what is involved in the experience of each moment, then you can see that they just can't. They just can't arise together, because there's the desire for and the desire against that they just don't arise simultaneously, but they do go back and forth. And that's why when you consider anything around our actions and karma, it's not one force. There's a lot of other things that are reinforcing it. So if you do find yourself involved in a greedy action, then you can catch that. Then you can bring in right view instead of letting the greed reinforce greed, or instead of hating yourself for doing the greedy thing. You know, the greed and the hate, the greedy. So then you can shift somehow to the right view and get off the unwholesome tract and shift to another wholesome, a wholesome mode.
So aversion would fit in that little context too, because it's...
Yeah, I used aversion. I used the term aversion a few times. In the West, we tend to use softer language, but aversion.
Hate.
But in the Abhidhamma, they just call all of that hate.
Okay.
You know, even a subtle impatience, it's hate, you know, because they're looking at the root that it comes from. So, yeah, they count that as hate. And the greed includes conceit. It includes, it's not just like, ooh, greedy, 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 greedy. You know, it's the things of the wanting.
Yeah. Thank you. This is something to think about. And look at. I appreciate it.
I see Jeremy. Why don't you go ahead and ask him again?
It's Jerome, not Jeremy.
Oh, Jerome? Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah. So does this imply that compassion and generosity cannot be simultaneously present?
Compassion and generosity can, first of all, you mean in an act of giving, for example, one could be motivated out of the wish to both alleviate somebody's pain and the wish to share.
I think it's more like if hate and greed can't be simultaneous, can love and compassion be simultaneous? Because those are the opposites.
Actually, in the Abhidhamma, when the Abhidhamma analyzes a state of compassion, the factor, it's not called loving kindness, it's called non-hate, is present along with compassion. And when they analyze a moment of loving kindness, then they highlight the strength of non-hate. So it's not the term metta, it's the term non-hate.
Okay.
Those are compatible. I'm saying those are compatible.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Yeah, they're compatible. Not everything's incompatible. Okay, we'll say, Yes, Shia.
Your example of the rats underneath your house, which is a good example because I've gone through this same conundrum with the termites in my house, which is, you know, and I sort of came to, well, yes, that the root of my hatred for the termites is that I consider it as my house, that I don't have a global enough view that this house is not really my house, but it's really, you know, for my use. And maybe the termites have an equal right to my house as I do. But in the end, I could not get to that place internally to say, well, these termites, it's mine for the moment, so you guys have to go.
Yeah. So from the perspective of this, the decision to, whether you make the decision to kill or not kill, you're making the decision at least knowing the wrong view of it.
Yeah.
So you're not reinforcing the delusion that reinforces, oh, this is, you know, this, you're not bringing in the wrong view of it, even if you're making the decision to kill. You're going to have consequences. Every act has consequences, but not only for the termites, but also for you. But you at least made the choice with knowing that it was killing. And that's one of the things that is emphasized in this, because that can reduce the tendency, like it's creating the reluctance to kill. And therefore, it's still strengthening the restraint, even if it doesn't strengthen it to the point that you give your house to the termites, or you just tolerate them and hope that they eat for a while and move on. Yeah. Right. So that's why it's complex. It's never as simple as, oh yes, we just take the precept and that's that. But we certainly can watch what the mind does when we come to one of those situations, and do we reinforce delusion around it in addition to whatever decision you make. And there are ways of doing things that reduce the killing, reduce the harm that's done. You know, some ways of even just protecting the house afterwards, so you don't have the same problem 5 years from now. You know, that kind of thing. I know some people who never, like with the rats, they never fill the hole, so then they have to kill again. Rather than, you know, you take care of it in a way that tries. You know, that tries.